Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. G'day, I'm Liz Guinness, and welcome to Talking Australia. Today I'm joined by Ian Morris, who's a teacher, biologist, conservationist, author, and all-round incredible human being. Ian has spent the past 50-odd years living and working in East Arnhem Land, and as you'll hear today, his passion for culture and people there is palpable. So join me today as Ian reveals the many gifts of this remarkable region of Australia. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss a second. Welcome to Talking Australia, Ian.
Nice to be here.
Oh, wonderful to have you all the way up in sunny Darwin. What's the temperature like today up there?
Well, yesterday we had one of the hottest days in June ever. So the temperature is rather beautiful this time of year. It is our really best period in the year now. But yesterday was right up there.
What are you talking about in terms of temperature? Was it like 30s or?
Oh, it was about 34, 35 where I was. And that was in the latter part of the afternoon, but it made the news as our hottest June temperature.
Yeah, I saw that last night. I envy you sitting down on near Sydney. It's a little cooler down here. We got to about, I think it was 9 degrees this morning when I jumped out of bed. So I much prefer the 30s than the single digits. But anyway, there you have it.
Yes, me too.
I'll swap you any day of the week.
I was born in Sydney, but I think I lost my southern resistance living up here so long. I do love going south anywhere in Australia, but it's always nice to come back to the tropics for me.
Yeah, definitely. So you said you've lived in the territory for quite a while now. How old were you when you first headed up there?
Well, my family were involved in Arnhem Land along the coast from after the Second World War onwards, and I had an uncle who was in Changi prison camp for the duration of the Second World War, and he was a design engineer. When he finally made it back out again and regained his health a year or two later, all he wanted to do was repair damage done to Australia by the Japanese bombers along the coastline. So he and his wife began rebuilding programs in Indigenous communities along the coast, and they loved the work, they loved the people, and they spent their whole life doing that. And as a young boy in Sydney, the son of his younger brother, we always had Indigenous kids staying with us and their parents in our home in Sydney while I was doing courses and all sorts of things. The kids would come to school with us. So from a very early age, all I wanted to do was to go to Arnhem Land and learn what these kids had learnt and see where they lived. And they sort of knew everything about the environment and it excited me. And we weren't taught anything about that sort of thing in Sydney very much. So from about the age 9, I've been involved with the top end of the Northern Territory here and its Indigenous people, and I feel very blessed in having been able to experience that.
Yeah, so that's, if you don't mind me saying, that's almost 60 years of involvement.
Correct.
With those communities, yeah? Yeah, okay. So those young students that were coming down, were those trips assisted by your uncle? Is that something an initiative he was running?
Yes, yes. He became the superintendent of the Elko Island Mission, as it was known in those days, and they would often send people, married couples often, down to train in various aspects of competing with the modern world, language and all sorts of things, and they would always bring their kids. And their kids would become little black celebrities in our primary school in Sydney, and we couldn't get enough of it. And I'm still the same today.
I remember that. I grew up in regional New South Wales, so a little place called Bellingen, and we had a few Aboriginal students as well, and you know, they were well adored. Mm. You know, I guess it was something different at the time. It wasn't something that was, you know, the norm, but
Yes, certainly great mates were made in the schoolyard for sure. So you finished school and then you trained as a high school science teacher, is that right?
Yes, I did zoology first at UNSW in Sydney, and my objectives were always to become a zoologist and get out there with the wildlife of Australia and have a good time. Then I realised, a lot of complicated things happened. I had to register for national service in those days, and most of my mates were being sent to Vietnam, and I was expecting that to happen. And I missed out by a day, so I was suddenly free. At the same time, the principal of the school up on Elko Island, Shepparton College, he had been getting me to talk to the secondary students about my zoology training in Sydney, and the kids were really excited about the scientific side of wildlife, and it went so well. The principal said, I'd like to offer you a role in my school and teaching, and I did a fairly shallow dip ed, as they call it in those days, zoology to get me into the school, and then I realised I needed a lot more training, and this was a far bigger subject than I anticipated, and I went back to uni for another 4 years. But from there on, my address was Arnhem Land, I'm still doing that same sort of work in and out of schools. These days, I'm not a teacher. I get invited in to work on projects with various schools across the north here.
So a project would be, just to give me an example of what you mean.
Okay. One of the projects that we've been doing a lot of work on ties in the Aboriginal people, their history, their land management up until European arrival and that sort of thing, in with the modern world. So we're really looking at two aspects of the same thing. And it involves the parents of the kids and their grandparents often coming in and telling us about the old days and what they were doing when they were the age of their children or grandchildren. And we'd have this kind of traditional input into our classrooms that was invaluable. And we've been building up a bit of a data bank on this area before it's too late, because a lot of that Indigenous traditional knowledge is being pushed out by modern education programs and all sorts of things. Often with Indigenous people, all their science is tied up in their languages. They have very complex languages, very difficult to translate it across into English. So they didn't look like they were very scientific in the early days to European people. And in fact, they're very scientific, and we're suffering the consequences of not taking that seriously now in Australia, particularly with the management of our national parks and natural areas.
And so an example of that would be, I imagine, burning off.
Burning is certainly a serious aspect of land management. And again, we didn't recognise what they were doing. And now we know through our own scientific processes that what Indigenous people were doing on the landscape up here was a benefit both to the natural ecosystems and to the humans, and it maintained a really complex system. And today we've moved in with all our modern technology and trashed the joint, really. We've really run it backwards seriously, and we're still in that same situation in North Australia today with our misuse of fire, misunderstanding of the ecological role of fire.
So if I take you back to when you first came up to the Northern Territory and you started teaching there, was there a language barrier at that point? How did that all work?
Well, in those days they were all mission schools. The government had no role in Indigenous education in those. They left it up to the various mission agencies quite a range of them. All very, very good, I might add. I was incredibly impressed with their integrity in education. And language, yes, any non-Indigenous teacher in Indigenous school had to learn the language of the children, and that was mandatory. And we had to do three afternoons a week as teachers in the Adult Education Centre, and we were instructed by an Indigenous guide who took us through the language very thoroughly. So after about 2 or 3 years, external teachers, non-Indigenous teachers, were quite fluent in the language, and it was lots of fun. And I've benefited from that since those days. It's still very important to me.
Yeah, definitely. Was it a difficult process?
No.
I mean, it wasn't.
No, because I was excited about it. It was like opening a door for me. All this science that they had, the intricate ways that they looked at the landscape, was all tied up in their language. And the only way I could get access to this was to learn it and then document it. I've been doing that. I took that into park management after I changed from teaching across to working for Australian National Parks and Wildlife Service, and it's been most useful. And it's a science that's been quietly killed off by the modern world without even it being recognised, and it's a bit of a shame. But we are now making efforts to arrest this. The disappearance of this wonderful Australian science that was here before we got there.
So at the moment you speak three different languages?
Well, in Arnhem Land there are many languages, not just three, and most Arnhem Landers are bilingual in that their mother speaks one language and their father speaks another language, but then they have other relatives that speak third, fourth, fifth, sixth languages. And I learnt very early in the piece that the children in my classrooms were multilingual. They could hear many of the local languages, or all of them actually, and then they would answer back in their father's language. That was kind of politeness. So whenever you spoke to a person, you could tell what clan they belonged to and where their geographical country was, and there's a whole lot of information. So there were these multilingual conversations going on in the classroom all the time where kids spoke their father's language, but they were fluent in mum's language and mum's language and so forth. It goes out like that. So they're very clever with language, and they're very precise, a lot more precise than English is with their languages. To answer your question, once I learnt the language of the school, which was a language called Jambarpoingo, once you learn Jambarpoingo, you can then listen to some of the other languages because they have a lot of commonality. The uniqueness in each language is kind of brought about through the land that those people live on, their traditional country. So it's land affects language in an amazing way.
So when you say that, do you mean, this is very basic, I suppose, representation of it, is if you came from a desert area, then the land would be, the language would be informed by that because you are talking about sand and a particular type of vegetation, whereas if you came from, you know, the rainforest, it would be different again. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. It goes back to their social system. As I said, your mother comes from one clan group and one geographical area, and your dad from another, are quite different. So marriage in Aboriginal traditional circles meant that you were born into a family where you physically inherited your father's country and the responsibility for looking after that, but you also inherited your mother's country and a spiritual kind of role in the management of that mum's country sort of thing. And so language was kind of tied to that country. The Aboriginal people in Western Arnhem Land cannot understand people way over in Eastern Arnhem Land because in traditional times they never met each other. Quite specific on where you went and how you spoke and how you conducted yourself. There was all these amazing social rules that went with language. And it's quite a complex social picture, but very, very neatly designated. You really fit onto your country. So when Indigenous people say, you know, I'm part of my land, to us white fellas, that's kind of no real deep meaning in that. But to Aboriginal people, it's everything to them. In every aspect of their life, they're tied to their land and the responsibilities that go with that. So. As you grow up in that, as I did as a young person, you suddenly realise the magnitude of this social system that they lived under. And, of course, in the early days, that got trashed too because they pushed people off their country and they jammed all sorts of different people together and their kids didn't learn the proper rules for the land. And the whole social system deteriorated. Here in the north, in Arnhem Land, we're very lucky because that didn't really happen like it did in most other parts of Australia. So the languages and the whole social system is still quite intact, and it's very exciting to be a part of that.
Yeah, definitely. And that, you know, you say that it was remained intact, presumably because there just wasn't as much white
correct. Yes.
occupation. Yeah.
And the missionaries okay. wanted the people to keep their country and to keep their languages and to be proud of who they were. And that's, in the long term, that's been a fantastic thing. So I just love sitting around under trees with the old people. We talk about the old days, and they look at the at what the missionaries did up here and how it affected their lives into the modern world. And they speak very fondly of those times, and they wish that their grandchildren could have experienced a lot of those sorts of things. But, it's an interesting part of Australia up here.
Oh, it sounds fascinating. I'm wondering if, someone's listening to this and thinking they want to know more about it. Can you think of any resources or any websites that people could go to learn more or read more? Or
yeah, sure.
Is there any available?
That wonderful film that they made called Ten Canoes, that's always worth a look, mm-hmm. because a lot of the aspects of the unique lifestyle of these people comes out in that film. All the sense of humour and all the funny things that was made right on the country out there in Central Arnhem Land, Central Northern Arnhem Land. There are many books written. There's anthropologists came up to Arnhem Land in the 1930s and 1940s, and in order to carry out their role studying human beings, they had to learn the language, and there's one book called A Black Civilization by Lloyd W. Warner, written a long, long time ago. But this guy was tuned right into the people in their traditional sense, and he kind of analysed their society. And I recommend that to lots of people because that information is no longer available, and the world has changed. But that gives you a kind of a window into who these people were traditionally, and that really helped me in as an outside Westerner coming in to live in those circles. Really helped me to understand who these people were. But there are many other resources as well. But it's funny, you know, Arnhem Land, the top northeast section of the Northern Territory, has been kind of shut away. It had no real resources that white people wanted to get hold of. Until a reasonably recent times, and they found a bit of uranium and a bit of this and a bit of that. But that helped the people to be able to look at the rest of Australia and see what happened and try not to let that happen to them, sort of thing. And so the culture has remained relatively intact, and now the young people are quite proud of who they are and who they were. That's something. Their personal integrity has been sort of protected by this remoteness, if you like, unique part of Australia.
We'll take a quick break and be back in just a moment. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
In terms of what you're doing now, what are you up to now? What are you doing?
Well,
from science teacher to
yes, I've moved into conservation. I like to work on the front line of where human beings meet natural systems, and I take that into schools. Kids get excited about our responsibilities as humans with managing the natural resources of Australia. And so that's in these modern times. I've been doing that a lot with my own people now. Guest lecturing on expeditions along our coastline in ships of, up to 100 people at a time, and introducing them to this natural world that we have here, and getting them excited about Australia. Often, we grow up in cities. We're divorced from the feel of the natural world. People can come up here on holidays now and get right into it. That's where I like to be. I'm also in payback mode because those old Aboriginal people, most of whom have gone now, who educated me as a teenager and a young person, that was an invaluable education. And I can't pay those people back directly, but today I've got their children and their grandchildren in schools and universities and things like that, and where I'm trying to do my bit for them in return for that marvellous service by helping their kids to get educated and get a good go at the world. So, I do quite a lot of that sort of work now in schools and universities and things like that. Also still involved with park management and with nature documentary making organisations like National Geographic and the BBC Natural History Unit. Sir David's group, they're often making documentaries in northern Australia here, and I find myself out there in the bush with them trying to work out how we're going to record something unique about Australia. Just recently we've been looking at the beautiful little Goulian finches that live in the rocky hills south of Darwin, and they're one of the most stunning little birds, and that's good because their story's going into a new BBC series called Life in Colour, and these little guys certainly have life in colour, and we've been looking at the private lives of these little birds and how they interact with other species around them and the sorts of trees that they use to raise their young in, because those trees give them protection from predators through camouflage and so forth. So all these wonderful little details we know very little about are now starting to come out, and hopefully will be on everybody's television screens in the next 12 months or so.
Oh, look, it sounds amazing. The little Gouldian finches, for people that don't know them, they have a little red cap, a little orange cap, is that right, or cheek?
Well, they have, there's two colour phases, there's actually three, but you can get them with black heads or red heads, and every now and then there's a genetic hiccup and one will come out with a golden head, about one in every thousand, we think, is a golden-headed Goulian. But they have all these contrasting colours in their plumage, and it just looks beautiful. When you see one up close, it's breathtaking.
Yeah. And they're tiny little things, aren't they?
Yes, just a small finch, less than a sparrow size.
Yeah. So I imagine it takes a bit of... So are they in great numbers up there, or is it...
They were in serious peril. Because of their beautiful plumage, they became very popular in aviaries, and because people were happy to spend big money on our little Goulian finches, then a trapping industry grew up very, very quickly in North Queensland, Northern Territory and the Kimberley region of Western Australia, where the Goulians live naturally. And it almost exterminated them. And massive numbers of Goulians, they were caught in nets, a whole flock at a time, exported south to pet shops. Many of them died on the way, and many of them died because of the climate change. They went from the tropics to the temperate zone, where you have very cold winters, and they didn't have any underfeathers to protect them from that cold weather, so these beautiful little birds would fall off their perches. And so as a result, the wild populations crashed, and on top of that, the trappers let a disease go in amongst the wild birds called air sac mite, and it was transferred from the adults to the chicks in the nest. So these little birds had come out of their nests with asthma. They couldn't breathe properly, so they were picked off by the predators. So our Goulian finch population was in serious trouble until a little while ago, when some conservationists got onto the problem. State governments stopped issuing licences for trappers, made it illegal, and the disease was cleaned up by an amazing biologist who worked for the Northern Territory government here and figured out how to reverse that disease going through the population, a bit like COVID-19.
Right.
And COVID's a crow, of course. So our finches are now seeing a comeback, and where we've recently taken the BBC Natural History Film Unit is an area not too far south of Darwin where we were seeing dozens of Goulians coming down to drink in the dry season around the water. And now we're seeing up to, well over 1,000 at a time. So their numbers are picking up, and it's a wonderful story.
So if I can take you back to, I guess, education and the learnings that you had in terms of the environment from the Indigenous peoples up there. I'm just kind of fascinated. We talked about the burning in terms of, you know, the science of the Indigenous science, but what would be another example of to give people a clear idea of what it means to learn the science of the people that have inhabited, you know, that region for tens of thousands of years?
Well, interestingly, I think of a whole lot of things all at once at the moment, but one good example, while I was teaching on Elko Island, a lady from James Cook University did a survey of the dugong populations in northern Australia, and, of course, they're a relatively endangered marine mammal. And so she surveyed the populations across the north, mainly from the air, and at the time, she contacted me and asked me, you know, a little bit about what the population at Elko Island did with dugongs. And I said, well, they barbecue them, they eat them, but they also love them and respect them. So I started a study with my secondary students, and we found that in a population of about 2,500 people on that year, they ate 11 dugong. Now, we had literally hundreds in our populations here, and there are a lot of rules. Dugong meat is very, very, it's like pork in another way, but it was used for special occasions and only certain people could go and hunt dugong and only certain people could eat certain parts of dugong. Lots and lots of rules associated with it. And what came out of it for me was these people had a real empathy with the species. They loved the dugong. They didn't want to see the dugong endangered in any way, so there were all these strict rules. And then this lady found out that a lot of the populations, the remaining populations of dugong in North Australia, were sort of centred around Aboriginal coastal Aboriginal communities, which seemed a bit strange, seeing as they ate them. And then it occurred to all of us that because of the rules with harvesting dugong, the Indigenous rules, they were encouraging populations of dugongs to be healthy. They were taking out the slow ones probably, and they weren't allowed to take cows or calves because, you know, that's part of the breeding cycle. And there was a real conservation practice going on which manifested itself in the fact that the dugong populations were healthiest around places like Elko Island. We were quite impressed with the results of this survey. And it brought out to the kids that conservation was certainly practiced to the highest degree in their traditional lives. So that was just one aspect that I learnt more than my students did about Aboriginal science or about science in general. And my job was to sort of show them the equivalence of what was going on around them. And quite often there weren't too many equivalents of what was going on around them. And particularly with conservation, we were seeing fishermen drowning dugong. They were floating dead upside down onto our beaches from drowning in nets and all sorts of problems that Aboriginal people thought were pretty horrifying, really, for a species that they revered. So it was a very interesting time for me. And I've been trying to promote a lot of these traditional scientific values that I came up against in my time.
And how do you do that? How do you? I mean, it, obviously, it makes perfect sense when you know you were just talking about it then. And I said, well, of course, it's like, you know, when people saying, well, a farmer's going to destroy their soil by over farming, and you think, well, that makes no sense because they glean their livelihood off the land. So if they destroy the soil, then they won't have a livelihood. And I guess it's a similar thing, obviously, with the dugongs. How do you take that message out and have it be heard?
Examples around us today, Kakadu National Park is a good example. It was declared a national park for all the wrong reasons. It was declared a national park because the government wanted to get access to the uranium deposits that were there, and in order to get the traditional owners to sign it over so they could mine it, they agreed to manage the land around that area as a national park, and they decided they'd do it jointly with the traditional owners. I still don't think the Commonwealth Government understands what joint management really means because it's not really never been jointly managed. Aboriginal people are there. The traditional owners live in the park, but they have a very, very minor role in the management of the place. It's all done by modern funding and modern technology and And it's as a result, the ecosystem in Kakadu has paid a big price. When the park was declared in 1979, there were virtually no endangered species, no threatened species. Everything was in good order. And in my opinion, that was because it had been managed to a large degree by these traditional owners. The buffalo industry had come in earlier and changed the fire regimes a bit, and we could see the downgrading in some areas with bad burning. Aboriginal people said, we can fix that. We know how to fix that. But that really hasn't been allowed to happen. And today, most mammal species, most vertebrate animals in Kakadu National Park are in some kind of peril. Some have disappeared. We don't know where they went. We've had some pretty intense fire management going on using helicopters and all sorts of things like that, and it really has gone the wrong way. So it's a wake-up call if we're looking and listening to the fact that Australia had been managed for, we think, about 65,000 years and probably more by Indigenous groups who had an empathy with the land that they were managing when they lit their fires. They knew what the fire was going to do. They knew when it was going to go out. They knew how it affected every plant and every animal. And in order to have a good standard of living, they had to make sure that fire benefited the plants and the animals, and therefore they would say, there's one day in the year when is the right day to light a fire in this particular place. And if we're too early, the fire won't achieve its any benefits, and if we're too late, it sends the system backwards. And if the fire happens really out of timing, you can put the system back 5 or 10 years. You can prevent the flowering of the eucalypts in that ecosystem for 3 or 4 years until it regains its momentum. Well, we don't really know a lot of that stuff, and we burn for all sorts of industrial reasons, hazard reduction, fuel control. There's all sorts of technical terms, but we don't have that empathy with the land that these people had, and we need desperately to learn and understand that, I think, if we want to manage Australia properly.
That's it for part one of our conversation with Ian Morris. Don't forget to join us for part two.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and hear you next time.